This is Fresh Air. To help us focus on where the civil rights movement is headed today, we spoke with Roger Wilkins. The civil rights movement has always been a part of his life. His mother was a social activist who became the first black president of the National Board of the YWCA. His father was a journalist. His uncle Roy Wilkins was the head of the NAACP. Roger worked briefly for the organization and went on to become Assistant Attorney General of the U.S., a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer, and a columnist. He's now a professor at George Mason University in Washington, D.C., and writes a column for Mother Jones magazine. Wilkins describes the civil rights movement today as decentralized, with leadership coming from the traditional civil rights organizations, black elected officials, grassroots groups, fraternal and social groups, and black intellectuals. I asked him if he sees the lack of centralized leadership as a problem.
I think white people have always wanted to look at black America and say, X speaks for black America, and now we know what the agenda is, and now we know either what we need to do or whom we need to refute. And I think that that's been an impulse in local situations and in national politics. So the idea that, well, the leader is Martin King or the leader is Jesse Jackson or who is the successor to Martin King, those are white people's questions, I think. They're not black people's questions. We are a very varied people. And there are, I don't know, something like 32, 33 million of us. You can't expect there to be one leader. Can't expect us to have one single aspiration or set of aspirations.
So if the question of, like, who is the leader is really a white person's question, what do you think are the questions black people are asking now about the movement and about leadership?
Well, I think a lot of black people are asking themselves whether the old traditional organizations are serving the new needs of black people. The problems are much more complex than they were when I was a young man. When I was young, we had one big common enemy, and that was segregation. And it's gentler, but still deadly offshoots in the North. Well, now it's enormously difficult, and it's a range of things. Some of it is just raw racism. Blacks finding it much harder to get mortgages than white people. In fact, a study by the Federal Reserve Board demonstrated that blacks in the highest income category were turned down more frequently than whites in the lowest income category when they applied for mortgages. That's just sheer, rank racism. In addition, the National Center on Opinion Research last year did a survey of whites and found that whites, by and large, believed that blacks were less intelligent than whites, less patriotic, less courageous, less hardworking. So there's a lot of the old-fashioned stuff, but it doesn't manifest itself, by and large, in the same old vicious ways. What I'm saying to you is that being black still affects the quality of life for all of us here in the country, but the sources of our discomfort or our pain are much more diffuse and much more difficult to identify, and therefore, it seems to me and to a lot of other people that our leadership organizations need to do a better job of analysis, of description, and of prescription.
Well, do you think that the traditional black leadership groups like the NAACP, the Urban League, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, do you think that they haven't changed with the times, that they haven't kept up with the issues? They've been criticized, for instance, for having leadership that is really aging and that younger people don't feel in sync with.
I would have to say that if you look at the leaders of the NAACP and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the National Conference of Negro Women, I'm about to be 60, and all these people are substantially older than I am. And I have been told emphatically by some of my younger friends and by my daughter, who is 32, that, you know, you're a useful fellow, Dad, but you're getting on. And I do think that in order for organizations to renew themselves, they have to encourage young people to take leadership positions. They have to be inviting to young people. They have to listen to young people. And they have to give young people a sense that their generation has a good chance of taking over the leadership in a reasonable time. And I don't sense that that's happening.
Do you think that there? I mean, even in the 1960s, a lot of radicals saw the NAACP as being kind of middle of the road. There were alternate organizations then. Do you think that there are strong alternate organizations now?
Well, the principal strong alternate organization in those days was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which has disbanded. There's also the Black Panthers, who were intellectual, radical, and sometimes gun-toting group, and CORE, which was at some stage moved to a more radical stance, which has virtually disappeared. You rarely see criticism of the mainstream leaders. And unfortunately, you rarely see statements, prescriptions, exhortations from the mainstream leaders. The people who speak most prominently about race these days are white conservatives. The responses, really, to the degree that there are responses from the black community, by and large come from academics. Now, I'm an academic, so I like us. I think we do a good job. but it's not our job, really. It's our job to do analysis. It's our job to write and think. But it's not our job to be out there on the front line, rallying the troops, putting vigor into local chapters of these organizations. That's what the leaders have to do. And I just don't see it happening.
My guest is Roger Wilkins. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roger Wilkins, and he's now a professor of history at George Mason University, a columnist for Mother Jones. He's formerly served in the U.S. Justice Department, the Ford Foundation, and he's been an editorial writer and columnist for the Washington Post. I want to get back to the traditional black leadership, the NAACP, the Urban League. Your uncle, Roy Wilkins, was the head of the NAACP, and when you were coming of age, he was already an executive in the organization. What did the NAACP mean to you when you were coming of age?
Well, from the time I was born, my uncle worked at the NAACP, and we lived in Kansas City, and I had two aunts and an uncle who lived in New York. My mother had two sisters who lived in New York, and my father had this brother who lived in New York. And my uncle was the tallest man in the family. He was taller than my father. He was taller than my grandfather. So when he came to town, there was this kind of tall man from this wonderful city, and he did these things, struggling for justice, struggling for decency for black people. And, of course, I lived in a segregated town, and I was bused to a segregated school. So I understood about the unfairness of racism, and I grew up with the NAACP in my blood.
When you were in college, you became an intern at the NAACP. What was it like for you to work in the organization? Was it addressing your interests?
It was when I was in law school, and the summer before I finished law school, I worked at the NAACP, and it was the summer after the Brown 2 decision, the implementation decision, summer of 55. So Thurgood sent a young woman named Alice Hartman, who was a same year in law school as I at Yale, and me down to the NYU Law Library to research the teacher tenure laws of all of the southern states, because they expected correctly that when the systems began to integrate, that black principals and teachers would be fired in large numbers. So Alice and I spent the summer researching the law and writing memos designed to help protect the job security of these black people. So it was great.
You've written about the responsibility of the black middle class to take on a leadership role in the movement, and I think that's created some interesting dilemmas in your life. Let me kind of run through a couple of points that you've brought up in your autobiography. Your father died when you were 9, and then your mother remarried eventually. Your stepfather was a doctor. He was very light, and you moved into a predominantly white middle-class neighborhood in Grand Rapids. And from your autobiography, it sounds like that gave you a bit of an identity crisis racially, being in a predominantly white area. And you've written about how about your acculturation in a white middle-class neighborhood and how you didn't grow up with easy access to black street language and street style, so that you felt kind of uncomfortable thinking of yourself as like going to work in a storefront ghetto operation or something. You'd feel slightly out of place there culturally.
Oh, there's no question that Grand Rapids in 1944 was hard for me. I mean, it was about as white a place as you could find, and people were not imbued with the sensitivities about race that people have now. It was awfully tough, and I had a lot of pain, and I had a lot of identity problems. American culture is a very powerful culture, and all the images in the culture at that time were white images. You didn't have black people in Life and Look magazines. You didn't have black people in the movies. You barely had black people playing. You didn't have black people playing baseball or football, anything. There were very few blacks in public life who people were led to admire. So what'd you have thrown at you? You had Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams. You had Sid Luckman, you had Robert Taylor and Lana Turner. And it was a tough culture to grow up in. Reflecting on it now, as I am a few weeks away from my 60th birthday, I'm glad it happened because I was able to ultimately to make a clear judgment that white people were not superhuman, that I was better than lots of them. I was not as good as some of them, that some were wonderful, some were awful. But I'm not, you know, I think if you grow up away from white people, if you're segregated, it's hard not to buy a little bit of the myth that white people are super people.
My guest is Roger Wilkins, professor at George Mason University and columnist for Mother Jones magazine. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the civil rights movement today with Roger Wilkins. I want to get back to the idea of the black middle class having a responsibility to not remove itself from the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of options you see for black middle class people who aren't necessarily going to be leaders of a mass movement, but who want to not just go through personal advancement and separate themselves from the larger movement?
I think that our tradition has been that we have been forced to take care of ourselves for as long as we've been here. We've only had a benign, moderately benign government looking at us since 1965. It's not been entirely benign, but it's been moderately benign. Prior to that, virtually all public policy in the United States was directed against us, against our interests, and designed to disable us from anything, any role in life other than menial, subservient, compliant, cheap labor. And in the face of that, we created churches back in the 18th century. Blacks created a church for themselves because they didn't like to be segregated in the white church in Philadelphia. Blacks participated in the Underground Railroad. Blacks had slave rebellions. After slavery, they created schools. They created normal schools. They created colleges. They created burial associations that grew into insurance companies and banks in order to take care of themselves. Toni Morrison has a great line in her wonderful novel, Beloved, where one character says to another, well, we've been pulling colored people out of the river forever. That's our tradition, pulling colored people out of the river. Well, things have changed in America in very significant ways. We've had more progress in my lifetime than I could have imagined from the vantage point of my childhood. On the other hand, the black poor are devastated by the deindustrialization. No, the whole economy is devastated by it, but the black poor are isolated. They're away from job networks. There are no institutions of any of any major consequence that serve them well. They are in a terrible fix. They are people who have just been left out of the last half of the 20th century. They live in brutal third world conditions in a first world country which values winners and hates losers, regardless of race. But when the losers are black people, the country is absolutely brutal. Well, these people are falling far and farther behind. We're facing a new challenge. Black America has to adapt its old traditions in order to pull these people in. Now, part of what we need to do is what the old leaders continue to do. Press hard for the government to provide employment, to provide education, to provide housing. Those are things that black people can't do themselves. The government has fallen down on the job. It's been awful. The black leaders need to continue to press that. But we need to provide more help to the institutions that help these people. We need to flood the schools with people who can help kids read. I look at these kids when I go into these schools. They're me when I was in Harlem schools. They need to see somebody like me to know that they are worthwhile and that they can achieve. I think middle-class Americans, black Americans, are willing to do it, but nobody's telling them what to do. They're kind of confused. They don't know.
I wonder if you think that because of the growing separation between the middle class and the poor, if there's become something of a culture gap between the two, and if that makes it more difficult and more uncomfortable for the middle class to figure out where they belong, in like what they can do in doing something to help the poor.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, look, black people are Americans. We're not Mexicans. We're not Africans. We're not Canadians. We're Americans. We're exposed to everything that Americans are exposed to. And a lot of what American is individualistic and materialistic. My sense is that I guess what I'm arguing is that black people have had a richer tradition than individualism and materialism, that we have had a tradition of service. We have had a tradition of giving back. After all, Harriet Tubman freed herself from slavery, went to the North, had skills, could have lived a comfortable life, but instead continued to go back to the South to free other slaves and hired herself out as a seamstress in Philadelphia in order to make money to go back and continue her freedom work. Martin King, in our time, born with the equivalent in our community of a silver spoon in his mouth. His daddy was one of the biggest preachers in town. All Martin had to do was to go to school, become a preacher, and go and be assistant preacher in his daddy's church and someday inherit one of the biggest churches in town and be one of the big-timers. He didn't do that. He got shot for it, but he gave back. Well, the give back, that's what we should. If there's anything to learn from this holiday, which I really think of not just as Martin's Day, but as a day to celebrate all of the people who have participated in all these struggles over the time, it is that the black people have a tradition of giving back. The point of life is to be a useful human being and to make things better than they were when you got here. And so I think that needs to be articulated much more forcefully in our community than it is now.
Well, that's a nice note to leave us with. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Roger Wilkins is a professor at George Mason University and a columnist for Mother Jones magazine.